You pray to have your name scattered on the lips of the young. Now you claim that it's you on the tips of their tongue. And if you're proud of what you had to kill to get your thrill, well, I bet it stings to give up everything and realize that they don't want you.
Chapter 32, The Time of Monsters. The atmosphere on the Twilight was tense, which actually made it feel disconcertingly normal, as long as Anakin let his eyes go slightly out of focus and didn't think too much about where they were or what they were doing. He had Obi-Wan on one side of him, and several of Queen Amidala's royal guards on the other, with Quinlan, Luminara, and Barriss sitting across from them on the jump seats in the ship's main hold. The Twilight had been destroyed the previous year in his own universe, but it wasn't as though Anakin had never flown it into combat before, including with a handful of his own troops a couple of times. The memory left a pit in the base of his stomach. Rex was on Naboo. There hadn't been any reason to argue for bringing him to Alderaan, not considering the size of the Queen's retinue already, and it was supposed to have been a short trip. He hadn't even protested. He'd never thought to do so. "He'll be fine," Anakin told himself, or tried to. Rex was an experienced trooper, probably more so than any of the Naboo soldiers in Theed. And he knew how the Republic fought. He'd be fine. Anakin just had to make sure that he and Obi-Wan and Padme went back to Naboo to get him before trying to use the Ouroboros again. Which was easier said than done right now, considering that Naboo apparently had what sounded like the entirety of the Gar camped out on top of it. "We're resourceful. We can manage it." And Rex was all right. He had to be. He'd survived command word retribution. He could survive this. Anakin clasped his gloved hands together, bouncing one knee impatiently. He and Obi-Wan were back in their robes and cloaks, which added to the feeling of dislocation, but at least would make a hell of a show coupled with the other four Jedi. Five, if you counted Captain Kenobi, but he was the only one of them not wearing the Jedi uniform. He didn't need that to make an impression, though, and he had made it explicitly clear that he wanted the rest of them in robes. Anakin supposed that if anyone knew the concentrated effect that a bunch of Jedi had on civvies, it would be him. He glanced around at Obi-Wan, sitting straight-backed in the jump seat with his legs folded tailor style. His eyes were closed. He looked calm. Then again, Obi-Wan actually liked this sort of thing, because he was the kind of weird masochistic adrenaline junkie the Jedi Order fostered, despite its continued reputation for boring aesthetics. "Nervous," Luminara said, apparently noticing Anakin squirming. Obi-Wan opened one eye to regard her, as Anakin snorted and said, "Please, this isn't my first nerf roundup. I've probably been on more combat missions than you, Master." Not that they knew that this was going to end in combat. Not that they knew it wasn't. Because it wasn't as though they were heading to Naboo the way everyone on Alderaan had clearly expected Queen Amidala to do. Not that they knew anything, really. Except that the Queen and Captain Kenobi were expecting the worst and had prepared accordingly. Anakin didn't know if, had he been the one making those calls, that he could have resisted the urge to at least go back to Naboo and scout around, see how bad the situation was. Instead, they were on their way to Raxus Secundus to meet with the rest of the Confederate Congress. According to what Anakin had heard, the Holonet report of the Queen's death was likely to leave the Congress in chaos, opening up the chance for the various factions in the Confederacy to jockey for power and probably self-destruct in the process. And then there was Palpatine. No one had any idea where he was, but Anakin would bet his starfighter that he hadn't been on Naboo when the Republic had attacked. Luminara considered him, Barriss watching warily from beside her left shoulder. Perhaps, she allowed, though Anakin wasn't sure that she actually believed what she was saying. She was Obi-Wan's age. Under normal circumstances, a knight Anakin's age would... Well, under normal circumstances, a Jedi Anakin's age would still be a Padawan, but definitely wouldn't have the same kind of experience as a knight. Okay, I have to know, Quinlan said abruptly, straightening up so quickly that his back popped audibly. What's with the glove? Anakin felt Obi-Wan tense beside him. That's a little personal, don't you think? The other Jedi looked taken aback.
Why?
It's fine, Anakin said to Obi-Wan after a moment of hesitation.
Let them see what they were fighting and what it did.
Catching his lower lip between his teeth, he undid the clasps of his right glove with his left hand, stripping it off so that the gold-colored metal of his prosthetic hand and forearm were visible. There was a long moment of silence. Obi-Wan looked at it, then away, bumping his shoulder against Anakin's in a reassuring kind of way. Eventually, Quinlan said,
"Training accident?"
It was rare, but it happened. Knights and Padawans trained with fully powered lightsabers all the time. Getting seriously injured in a training bout was usually viewed as a sign of poor control on the part of the opponent, since they should have been able to pull their blow. Anakin pulled his glove back on, resisting the urge to look away. He could feel the heat in his cheeks. No.
Vibroblade?
Obi-Wan gave Quinlan a disgusted look, and Luminara elbowed him in the ribs. Barriss's gaze flitted aside, as though she couldn't bear to look at the evidence of the injury. No, Anakin said, doing up the clasps by touch. He tried to meet Quinlan's eyes, couldn't, and stared at the wall behind his left shoulder instead.
Lightsaber. Sith Lord.
Obi-Wan rubbed a hand over his face. Quinlan blinked. Luminara stared at him, as Barriss said in a small voice,
But the Sith aren't real. They're a legend. They were all wiped out a long time ago.
Didn't tell your apprentice about that, did you?
Anakin thought. He and Obi-Wan had discussed the situation with Captain Kenobi and the two knights, but not the Padawans.
Come on, Luminara. Don't you think your apprentice can hack it?
Obi-Wan said quietly,
I assure you, Padawan Offee, the Sith are very real. It would be a mistake to underestimate them, solely because they seem to be something out of the ancient past.
That's one way to put it, Anakin muttered. He crossed his arms over his chest and leaned back against the bulkhead, closing his eyes as if preparing to go to sleep. Instead, he heard Ani Skywalker's voice over the ship's comm, the raw, flat syllables of his Tatooine accent scraping at Anakin's eardrums.
30 seconds to real space re-entry.
Anakin straightened up, bouncing a knee again. He saw the Jedi and the guards around him tensing, the guards checking their weapons, the Jedi trying to affect calm. The door slid open just as Obi-Wan said,
I have a bad feeling about this.
Do you seriously have to say that every time? Anakin said, nodding in thanks to the guard who stood up so that Padme could take the seat beside him. It was all by the time I was 11, and it's never useful, just cryptic. He leaned into the kiss that Padme pressed to his cheek, aware of the quick, calculating look Voss shot him.
You know, I think Qui-Gon said that to me once, Obi-Wan said thoughtfully.
Try 100 times, Quinlan said, rolling his eyes, then blinked as he realized what he had just said and to whom.
Obi-Wan just smiled. Possibly more than once, he allowed.
Shut up, you're going to jinx it, Anakin told him, then met his gaze in alarm as the ship dropped out of hyperspace and they both felt the shadow in the Force. The building where the Congress met on Raxus Secundus hadn't been constructed specifically for that purpose, since each session of the Congress was held on a different world to keep any one system from gaining too much power. Or, that was the theory, anyway. It was why Queen Amidala had vetoed the bill that would have put the Congress permanently on Naboo. Here on Raxus, they were using the Parliament building, meaning to house delegates from across the Raxus system, as well as the system's handful of colony worlds. The main chamber was a large, rectangular space with tiered benches lining all four walls, a speaker's podium at one of the short ends, and tables set up with speaking stations at the center of the floor. Rio thought that it was a lovely space, all native wood and tall glass windows that spilled light down onto the floor. She couldn't imagine anything more different than the convocation chamber where the Galactic Senate met. The building's air conditioning system was strained to within an inch of its life, so much so that some of the other beings in the main chamber were shivering against the cold. Rio Chuchi still felt sweat beating up on the back of her neck. Pantora was much, much colder than this, and being outside in the planet's oppressive heat made her want to lie down and melt into the pavement. Inside was bearable for her, but just barely. Her only real consolation was that Chairman Chicho had to be just as uncomfortable as she was. Pandora's chairman was seated in one of the viewer's boxes that overhung the chamber, rather than on the tiered benches that ran along the walls. If they had been in the convocation chamber, he would have been in the same repulsor pod as Rio, and she was sincerely glad that he wasn't. She clasped her hands on top of her knees, resisting the urge to try and wipe sweat from her face. Down below on the floor, she could see the speaker's podium, currently empty but flanked by a pair of armored Naboo clone troopers. Padme never used armored guards, Rio thought, but Padme Amidala was dead, and everything was different now. She didn't know Sheev Palpatine very well, just enough to nod at him in passing. She hadn't entered the Galactic Senate until well after he had been ousted from office, and during her time in the Confederate Congress had dealt directly with Queen Amidala, rather than with Naboo's delegate. She knew that Chi Cho had dealings with Palpatine, but her polite inquiry a few months ago had been brushed off with a brusque dismissal and a comment about it being a private matter. Technically speaking, the chairman didn't hold any rank in the Congress itself. Taking the delegate's position would have meant admitting that he was subordinate to the president. Chicho would never do that. He preferred to have Rio in Pantora's seat, just as long as she didn't speak up too often and never contradicted him. Since Rio had liked Padme Amidala considerably more than the chairman, she was more than happy to get out from under his thumb as often as she could. It wasn't as though Chi Cho needed someone else to speak for him. The only occasions upon which Rio had actually been able to speak in the Congress had been when he was absent, and both times she had been brutally excoriated for it as soon as he heard about it, even though her contributions to the discussion had been relatively innocuous. Somehow, Queen Amidala had found out about it. After the second time, she had taken Rio aside and told her that there was nothing wrong with what she had been doing, that she shouldn't let Chi Cho dictate her beliefs or her votes just because he was the ruler of the system she represented. "Don't forget that you are the delegate for Pantora, Congresswoman," she had said. "Take his opinions into account, certainly, but don't compromise your own beliefs or the well-being of Pantora for Chairman Cho's pride. That will do neither you, Pantora, nor him any good, and it will only hurt all three in the long run." After that, Rio would have died for Padme Amidala on a battlefield, if only she had asked. "And now I'll never have the chance," she thought, staring down at the armored troopers. The words of the Holonews report, the first one since the Holonet Relays had come back online a few hours ago, still rang in her head. Rio was still hanging faintly on to "believed to be," since that was very different from "confirmed to be." But as the hours had ticked by without a rebuttal from the Naboo, her hope had faded. She was certain that the queen would never have stood for that sort of slander.
Grim, isn't it?
Rio looked up as Mina Bonteri settled down into the bench beside her, stretching out her legs until her feet bumped the back of the next bench. The delegate from Onderon was old enough to be Rio's mother, a tall human woman with graying dark hair and elaborate tattoos on her neck and bare arms.
I just keep thinking about Padme, Rio said quietly. I would have thought that the Republic would have preferred to take her alive.
Perhaps they wanted to spare the publicity and expense of a messy trial, Mina said.
She sighed.
Or perhaps Padme wanted to spare them the opportunity.
Rio looked at her sharply. Padme wouldn't have killed herself.
I would have, Mina said bluntly. But the Naboo don't think about that sort of thing the way the Onderonians do.
Padme would have seized a public trial as an opportunity, not a humiliation. She sighed, lacing her hands together over her stomach. They sat in silence for a few minutes, watching the other delegates begin to file into the meeting hall. Some of Queen Amidala's other allies made their way along the seating gallery to join them. Kin Rob of Taris, Onaconda Farr of Rhodia, Mina Tiles of Dak. Congressman Farr, who had known the Queen almost as long as Mina had, looked especially downcast. He sat down next to Mina and looked at her for a long moment. She took one of his long-fingered hands in both of hers.
"It may not be as dire as it seems," she told him, though she obviously didn't believe the words herself. "Padme is a survivor. Do you remember the occupation all those years ago? Everyone thought that she had been killed then, and she turned out to be perfectly safe. Of course the Republic wants to blow it out of proportion."
"I'm not sure that trapped on an occupied world fighting for her life is how I would define perfectly safe," Mina Tiles said.
Anaconda gave her the ghost of a smile, then turned back to Mina.
"I am certain that the Republic will never be able to destroy Padme Amidala," he said. "But I worry that our troubles lie much closer to home."
He turned his head to look down at the speaker podium and added,
"I fear that Padme may have been the only thing holding the Confederacy together. If she is truly dead, as Congressman Palpatine claims..."
He let the words trail off meaningfully. Kin Rob, always practical, said in her shrill voice, "Is it true what they say about the military?" Rio looked up at the dark-skinned woman, frowning.
"What are they saying?"
She had been closeted with Chim and Cho and the rest of his cronies all day. Chi Cho wasn't particularly fond of her, but he knew that she had connections in the Congress that he lacked, and he had been trying to get her to use them. It had been illuminating, to say the least. The chairman thought very differently than she did.
Kin Rob lowered her voice slightly. "Naboo owns the clones and most of the fleet, doesn't it? And they practically worship Queen Amidala and Obi-Wan Kenobi. There's a rumor that with them dead, the military won't take orders from the Congress anymore."
Rio hadn't heard that.
"They'll listen to Palpatine?" she asked.
"No one has said anything about Obi-Wan," Mina pointed out quickly. "We don't know where he is."
"He would never have left Padme," Onaconda said glumly.
Frustrated by the change in subject, Rio looked at Mina Bonteri, who knew Padme and the Naboo better than anyone else in the Congress, and asked again,
"Will the Naboo military listen to Palpatine?"
Mina patted her knee in a reassuring kind of way.
"I don't know, my dear."
Rio glanced down at the armored troopers by the podium, standing stock still and unmoving in their white armor with the sigil of House Palpatine. At least, that was what she thought it was, painted in red on their shoulder plates.
"Some of them are listening."
"His honor guard hardly makes up the entirety of the army and navy," Mina said.
"But what if they don't?"
Kin Rob said, making them look at her.
Naboo has a stranglehold on the Confederate military.
Only because the Congress will not pay for it,
Anaconda pointed out. But if they refuse to listen to Palpatine, who is to say who they will listen to? That is a very great number of men and ships. Kinraab tapped her fingers against her knees in a quick, nervous gesture. Queen Amidala should have turned control of them over to the Congress long since.
We would have had to agree to pay for them, Rio said.
She leaned forward, lacing her hands together beneath her chin and resting her elbows on her thighs. It's not as though we haven't had this debate before. Padme said that Naboo would only keep financing the war if they kept direct control of the clones and ships that they paid for.
That was all well and good while the Queen still lived, but now...
She stopped as the door behind the speaker's podium opened and Palpatine came in, accompanied by one of his aides. Rio looked around, realizing that the room had filled up while they had been talking. This wasn't the first time that the Congress had been held on Raxus, since it had a space large enough to seat the whole Confederate Congress. Well, it had before the delegation of 2000 had seceded, but hardly any of them were here. There were other gaps, too, places where delegates hadn't come for one reason or another. Rio thought that the Holonet blackout had a lot to do with it, but she knew that there were delegates who had left after receiving the news of Queen Amidala's death. Palpatine stepped into the speaker's box, closing the short door behind him. Rio straightened up in her seat, tapping her fingers absently against her chin. Quiet spread through the room as the other delegates noticed Palpatine's arrival and ceased their conversations, waiting for him to speak.
"30 seconds to real space re-entry," Annie said. It was the first thing that anyone had said in the past hour or so, and the sound of his voice seemed to scrape at the recycled air in the cockpit. Ahsoka, Kenobi's Togruta apprentice, glanced up at the words. She was sitting with her hands knotted in her lap, practically vibrating with repressed excitement. She couldn't be more than 8 years younger than him. At most, it was sometimes hard to tell with non-humans. But Ani wished that he had her youthful enthusiasm. Tension had settled into a knot in the pit of his belly. He wasn't a mercenary or a bounty hunter, and he didn't like flying into a situation where he didn't know what would be waiting for him on the other end. He might carry a blaster, but that didn't mean he was a gunslinger. The cockpit door opened behind him, admitting Captain Kenobi and Queen Amidala into the room. Ahsoka stood up without being asked, and Kenobi took her seat, the Queen leaning her elbows on his seat back as Ahsoka moved to one of the other stations. They had both changed out of the elaborate clothes they'd been wearing when they'd boarded the Twilight back on Alderaan. The Queen was back in the white spacer's outfit she had worn on the Indomitable, a heavy purple waffle weave wrap thrown over her shoulders, and Kenobi was in gray and black again, his ornately patterned vambraces his only ornamentation. Ani wetted his lips, trying to think of something to say, but came up blank. The Queen and her retinue had been preparing for the worst ever since they had heard the news about Naboo. Ani had walked through the Twilight earlier and seen the members of the Royal Guard kitted out for a fight, the handmaidens checking their blasters, the Jedi doing whatever it was Jedi did to prepare for battle. The other Kenobi and Skywalker were wearing the Jedi uniform, which Ani hadn't expected and which had taken them by surprise. Even with their hoods up, Ani had heard Kenobi's strict order to them, they would be unmistakable as Jedi, which was the point. There was no one in the galaxy who didn't hesitate at least a little when confronted with a Jedi Knight. Ani keyed the all-ship comm. "Prepare to exit hyperspace," he announced, then gripped the hyperspace lever and pulled it down. Starlines streaked past the viewport, then steadied out. Ani tensed, his hand moving to the controls for the Twilight's forward guns, but after no collisions or missile lock alarms rang out, he let himself relax a little, flicking his gaze down at the sensor boards. "I read no enemy contacts," he said. All he could see was the civil defense patrol and some civilian traffic. On either side and just behind him, the N1 starfighters that had accompanied them settled into an escort pattern. "That's a good sign, right?" Ahsoka said, when neither Kenobi nor Amidala responded.
Maybe. Kenobi allowed. R2, feed him our approach vector.
R2-D2 beeped a response, and a moment later the figures began appearing on Ani's screens. He plugged them into the subspace navicomputer, watching the orb of the planet growing larger in the viewport. Raxus was a little bigger than Naboo, and from here Ani could see the blue of the oceans and the unfamiliar shape of the continents, wisps of white cloud obscuring parts of the planet. He'd only been here once before, running a cargo out from Lothal sometime last year.
"Looks nice," he said cautiously.
Kenobi canted him a look, raising an eyebrow in response. The Queen's hands were white-knuckled on the back of his chair.
"I'm not a Jedi. You actually have to speak if you want me to know what you're saying,"
Ani told him dryly.
"Looks can be deceiving," Kenobi said. "I have a bad feeling about this."
"Great," Ani muttered. "The Jedi has a bad feeling." He took the headset that Kenobi handed him, reading the unspoken request, then tuned the comm board's frequency to the general planetary traffic channel.
"Raxus Secundus, this is Naboo Crown 1 on approach. Repeat, this is Naboo Crown 1 and escort."
To say that the atmosphere in the council chamber was tense would have been an understatement. It had been tense when they had been deciding whether or not to rip Obi-Wan Kenobi's mind from his skull and remake it. Now, it felt as though all it would take was one spark and the entire order would burn. Adigalia sat on the edge of her seat, unable to lean back and relax, unable to even conjure up the illusion of serenity. She could sense the force gathering thick inside the room. With her eyes half closed, she could even see it, gathering in shimmering drifts of colors that Basic had no names for. Another Jedi might have described it as a sound, a smell, a taste. For Adi, it was sight. She could count on the fingers of one hand the number of times the Force had been so strong in a single place that she could see it. The only other time that it had happened in the Jedi Temple itself had been decades ago, when she had first taken her trials. That it was happening again now was hardly a good sign. "Nothing that's happened in the last month, in the last 13 years, has been good." Adi folded her hands over the armrests of her chair. She let her gaze pass quickly across the room, which was more than half full now, the last masters trickling in. Yoda and Mace, she knew, were coming from the Senate building. She couldn't stop herself from looking at Plo Koon, who was leaning back in his seat to talk to Shaak Ti and Syndralig. Sin wasn't technically a member of the High Council, but he had been summoned for this meeting for reasons Adi wasn't sure that she was comfortable with. No one would meet her eyes. They had heard about Stas almost as soon as the Milnet relays were back online. Holonet communications might still be down for civilians, but they were back for all government and military services, including the Jedi. And Admiral Tarkin had wasted no time in informing Coruscant what had happened on Naboo.
Since then,
Stas Alley had been Adi's apprentice 13 years ago. There was also a kin relationship, however faint. There weren't many Thalothian bloodlines, and they were something like second or third cousins once or twice removed. In the normal course of things, that didn't mean much for the Jedi, who didn't hold with familial relationships in the rare event that one cropped up in the Order. And there were a few cases here and there. The majority of Jedi weren't celibate, and every year or so there were Force-sensitive children born to knights, or more rarely to Padawans, who were raised in the creche. Beyond that, Force-sensitivity ran in families in some species. There was a human knight about Adi's age who had taken his brother's son as his apprentice. Blood connections in the Order didn't matter. Or at least, weren't supposed to matter. Right up until the point when they did. It was the same thing with cohorts and lineages. Nothing mattered, right up until it did. She looked across at Plo again, then away before he could see her watching him.
He had to be able to guess what was going through her head. They had been in the same cohort as younglings. Addy and Plo, Qui-Gon and Thulm, Syndralig and the Dark Woman, and a handful of other masters, some of whom were dead now. Sometimes the connections binding a cohort didn't last long past the creche. Other times... There was only one member of Obi-Wan Kenobi's cohort still in the Order. His had been a smaller cohort. His generation had been larger, but some of them had died between the creche and the present day, and the generation had been at the fore of this grouped into smaller cohorts as the number of incoming younglings began to wane. Addy began to tick them off mentally, for a lack of anything else to do while she waited for the last council members to arrive. Obi-Wan was gone, of course. Quinlan Vos. Numenara Unduli. Stoss Alley. Rig Nima. "We're going to pull Rig back from the front," Addy thought tiredly. They had to. She might be clean, she hadn't been as close to Obi-Wan as the others, but there was no way that the Council could take the chance that leaving her on Naboo would pose. Save her to have her in the temple, and send some other healer to Naboo in her place. Force, help me. This can't be happening. At least Qui-Gon Jinn hadn't lived to see this. Of course, if Qui-Gon had lived, there was a good chance that none of this would be happening at all. In the grand scheme of things, one night's life or death shouldn't have made any difference, but it was clear to Addy that Qui-Gon's had a very great difference. Addy resisted the urge to bury her face in her hands. This can't be happening. She had spoken to Stoss just before the fleet had left for Naboo. She'd had no idea. There had been no sign that this was going to happen. What was she thinking? How long had Stoss been a traitor to the Order and the Republic? How many others were there? How many are in this room right now? Addy didn't know how long she had been sitting there, staring blankly into space, until she felt a hand on her shoulder and jumped.
It's just me, Eeth Koth said.
Mother of moons! Addy lifted a hand to her forehead, trying to massage away some of the tension there, then got up and hugged him. She felt Eeth's moment of surprise at the gesture, then he returned the embrace. It's good to see you again, Addy told him sincerely. We feared the worst under the circumstances.
My death might have been preferable concerning the alternative, but I can't say that I disagree, Eeth said.
He released her and stepped back, holding her at arm's length as he studied her.
You look tired.
Can you blame me? Addy said, then shook her head and asked, You're well?
I'm unharmed, physically at least.
No, he added quickly, as her eyebrows shut up.
Not like that. Not like you're thinking. I'm just... tired.
Addy nodded slowly. Did she say why, Eeth? She had to ask. Did she say anything? Did Quinlan or...
Luminara would not explain herself, Eeth said.
Quinlan, he sighed.
Is it true?
She didn't have to ask what he meant. Addy glanced aside, unable to meet his eyes, and said,
Yes, it's true.
She looked back in time to see his mouth tighten.
How?
He asked her.
This is not the Old Republic. We are not the Jedi our ancestors were. Obi-Wan Kenobi is misguided and a threat to this order, but he is not a follower of the dark side, and he is certainly not Darth Revan. By doing this, the Council has created cracks in the Order that will be a long time in fixing.
I didn't vote for it, Eeth, Addy said.
Did you vote against it?
Addy didn't reply.
Eeth swore softly. We are Jedi. There are lines we do not cross.
You were not here, Addy said, surprising herself with the harshness in her voice.
She took a deep breath, then repeated more calmly.
You weren't here, Eeth.
Does this order cease to be the Jedi Order because I leave?
Jedi will die because of this decision, Adi. Jedi have been dying for 25,000 years, Eeth.
Adi snapped.
Jedi have been dying since the Force made us out of the blood and bone and star matter of the universe. What makes today any different?
Because it is our day, Adi, Eeth said.
He caught her shoulder in his hand, gripping tightly when Adi tried to turn away. We are not our ancestors. This is not their time. It is ours.
It is what we make of it.
That's easy for you to say. She glanced up as the chamber doors slid open, letting in Mace and Yoda. Through the open doors, she could just see Aayla Secura and Kit Fisto waiting out in the antechamber, flanked by temple guards. They were there for Aayla, Adi knew.
We caution ourselves against attachments and connections, but we can't help but create them, thrive on them, let them bring us together and drive us apart.
If she had been in Aayla's shoes, she didn't know if she could have come back.
Not with her master begging her to leave, and her line master, her master's master, already gone.
Eeth released Adi and took his own seat. Adi sat down, flexing her hands over the armrests of her chair as the other masters in the room did the same. Only Syndralig and the Dark Woman remained standing. Sin behind Plo Koon's chair, and the Dark Woman near Stacey Teen's. Slowly, the murmur of conversation quieted, leaving the chamber in silence.
Palpatine rested his hands on the sides of the podium in the speaker's box, looking around the big room with satisfaction. He had addressed the entire Congress before, of course, but only from the floor, not from the speaker's box, or wherever the president happened to be sitting or standing in whatever venue they were using. The Queen's concession to the reluctance of the Congress to decide on a capital, of all things, was one of many matters that had irked him greatly over the past few years. This continued hopping from one world and one makeshift space to another was untenable in the long run and unbearable in the short. The room quieted as the other members of the Congress noticed his presence. Palpatine looked around, taking note of which representatives were here and with what groups they were sitting. Raxus's Parliament building lacked anything like the carefully denoted repulsor pods in the Galactic Senate. Only about 2/3, maybe a little less, of the Congress was present. Many of the others hadn't been able to attend, either due to the Holonet outage or personal affairs on their homeworlds. Palpatine was also aware that about 100 representatives had left Raxus after seeing the Republic Holonet broadcast. Since only the official government channels were open on the Holonet, with the commercial ones rumored to start reactivating within the next 36 hours, there were no representatives present via hologram either. That left the most ambitious ones, the ones who thought that they could gain power in the vacuum of Queen Amidala's absence, however permanent or temporary that turned out to be, the true believers, and Amidala's partisans. It was something of a mixed bag, to say the least. Still, it would serve for Palpatine's purposes. He let his fingers flex against the sides of the podium, where a data screen displayed the speech that he had prepared. The speech that Chi Cho and the other rabble thought that he was giving. Palpatine hardly needed it, but allowing them to believe that they knew what they were dealing with would weaken them and catch them off guard.
I have waited so long for this.
Through Padme Amidala's obstinacy and concessions, through Dooku's intrigues and earnest goodwill, through the Jedi's idealism, through Obi-Wan Kenobi's vendettas, 100,000 lifetimes of the Sith spent in waiting, all to come down to this. It didn't matter whether the Republic had killed Queen Amidala or not. No one knew better than the Sith that it didn't truly matter what had happened, just what was believed. The reports of Amidala's death, real or otherwise, would sow the seeds of chaos in an already unbalanced galaxy, creating openings that Palpatine intended to exploit. Even her reappearance would not be believed by many. Her use of decoys was too well known. When the room had finally gone quiet, he cleared his throat, fixing an appropriately solemn expression on his face. "It is with great sorrow that I stand here today," he said. "By now I am sure that you have all heard about the tragic events that recently occurred on Naboo, my homeworld and that of Queen Amidala. Padme Amidala was, he allowed his voice to falter for an instant, "a remarkable woman. Were it not for her vision and tenacity, none of us would be here now. I know that not all of us agree with her in all things, but we cannot allow ourselves to forget the very great debt that we owe her. We cannot allow her sacrifice to be in vain." He paused, wondering for a moment if anyone would challenge his right to be standing in Amidala's place. But even her partisans were silent, watching him with suspicion that hung heavy in the Force. "The Queen and I were very close," he said. "I knew Padme since she was a young girl, when she had just taken up the mantle of rulership and was faced with what many of us would have called an impossible situation. The Trade Federation invasion and occupation of Naboo. No one had her kind of determination. I know that many of us hope that now, as we did during that long year of the occupation, that reports of her death are false, but I fear that we must proceed as if they are true. Hope will not sustain us. Hope will paralyze us. Hope will bring the Confederacy to ruination. We must not hope." There was a startled murmur from the watching delegates, beings looking around at each other before focusing back on him. Palpatine could feel the tension radiating from Amidala's partisans, as if they were wondering what game he was trying to play. "A different one than you, my friends. A game which has been frozen in a standstill for many centuries, and only now do we begin to make the final moves. The Confederate Congress was not alone in meeting today. The Republic Senate was as well, and while one Sith stood here, another was waiting on Coruscant to send a message to the Republic and the Jedi that no one in the galaxy would ever forget. It had been a long time in the making, but the Sith would have their revenge. Queen Amidala and I spoke often in the days before this vile attack," he went on. "As many of you are aware, the worlds of our Confederacy are not the only beings in the galaxy who have seen the hypocrisy and tyranny of the Republic and refused to stand for it. Just before she died, the Queen completed a series of negotiations with the Alliance of Sovereign Systems. This time, there was a much louder response from the Congress. Mina Bonteri of Onderon sat bolt upright, saying something that Palpatine couldn't hear over the sound of the crowd. "That will bring both the Confederacy and the Alliance together in a coalition united against the Republic. Together, we can bring the Republic to its knees. We can do as Padme Amidala would have wanted, and win the freedom of billions of beings from the tyranny of the Galactic Republic." In front of him, a red light began to blink at the upper right corner of the data screen, signaling an incoming comlink message being transferred from audio to text. Palpatine let his gaze flicker downwards to read it, careful not to let his expression falter.
"Incoming vessels exiting hyperspace. Class, modified light freighter. Corellian G9 Rigger. Class, 3 starfighters. Naboo Royal N1 Viper. Transponder signals register Naboo Crown 1. Grey Leader. Grey 3. Grey 4. Orders requested."
Palpatine did not allow himself to show any expression. Without looking away from the Congress, he tapped a quick response one-handed onto the data screen, knowing that the order would be instantly transmitted to the warships that had accompanied him to Raxus.
Destroy them!
Ani felt a whisper in his mind, like the cessation of air movement that preceded a sandstorm back on Tatooine, and grabbed at the Twilight's control yoke to send the ship straight down below the star's plane a bare second before a missile shot through the place where they had been. Too late? The ship's sensors screamed a warning. Hold on! Ani shouted, and jerked the yoke sideways. The Twilight went spinning into a barrel roll, the missile following them around as Ani tried to shake the blasted thing off. He couldn't shoot the thing down and stay ahead of it at the same time. The contact blinked off the boards.
Missile destroyed,
said Squadron Leader Miyake over the comm. Ani glanced down at his boards, straightening the ship out. Kenobi had pulled the Queen into his lap. He let her up now, and she staggered into one of the two back seats, sitting down with a heavy thump. What just happened? Someone shot at us, what do you think? Ani said, frowning. Something on his boards didn't look right. They...
Incoming fighters!
Miyake barked. At the same time, the sensor alarms went off again, and Ani's boards lit up. From here, he had a perfect view of a battleship moving out from where the mass of the planet's moon had concealed it, an unfamiliar construction that he couldn't identify immediately. It spat out a dozen starfighters that came boiling out towards them. Instinct alone sent Ani taking the Twilight into an evasive pattern. "Who the hell are these guys?" he said through clenched teeth. He switched control of the Twilight's forward guns over to the co-pilot's side and added, "Feel free to start shooting back any time now!"
"Quinn, I need you on the top gun," Kenobi said into his comlink, then gripped the controls and narrowed his eyes.
The Twilight's guns spat blaster fire, and one of the strange starfighters exploded in a burst of energy.
"Who are we shooting?"
"Think about it really hard, Quinn." The N1 Vipers streaked past the Twilight's viewport, one of them flipping around and firing green bolts of energy so close that they overwhelmed Ani's sensors for a moment. "They're trying to destroy me before I can speak to the Congress," the Queen said, her voice tight. "Captain, get me down to Raxus now. I don't care what you have to do to make it happen. Get me down there!"
For a long moment, no one spoke. Plo Koon could feel the force drawn thin and tight in the room. Every master there had to feel it, even if not all of them knew what it meant. What it might mean. There had been factions in the Jedi Order since its earliest days. Lineages, philosophies, political and social affiliations. More times than not, they were friendly. Only a few times in the Order's long and storied history had they come to violence, and never within living memory of anyone in the Order. Even Yoda hadn't been alive the last time that had happened, though he had known Jedi who had been. It was the first time in Plo's lifetime that it truly felt as though those factions had turned into battle lines, as though the fate of the Jedi Order stood balanced on a razor's edge. It must have felt like this a millennium ago, during the depths of the new Sith Wars. It must have felt like this 4,000 years ago, before Revan and Malak tore the galaxy and the Order apart. One way or another, when this meeting ends, the Jedi Order will never be the same again. He looked around the room, glad that his protective goggles concealed the quick flicker of his eyes. Most of the Jedi sat still, waiting. He could see that Adigalia was visibly distraught, her hands clenched tight on the arms of her chair, and her gaze a little unfocused, as though she couldn't bear to look at any of them. Eeth Koth, recently returned by the Naboo, seemed tired and a little weary. Plo had had the chance to speak to him a little since his arrival, but it hadn't been more than a few words. Deepa Balaba was watching Mace, her hands folded in her lap, the same way Shaak Ti was watching Plo. The others... Well, there were battle lines drawn, even if not everyone was sure yet what those battle lines were, or how deeply this might go.
"Fallen, Naboo has," Yoda said at last. "Fled Alderaan, have Queen Amidala and her followers."
"Are we to speak of the war or the Gundark in the room?" Stacey Teen said. "Let the Senate and the Admiralty deal with the Naboo. It is the Jedi we are concerned with." There was a faint murmur of unvoiced agreement in the Force, though no one spoke out loud. Yoda turned his head slightly to regard Stacey, who looked back at him without flinching. Then Ki-Adi-Mundi said in his soft voice, "I agree with Master Teen. There are other matters that must be discussed before we can turn our attention to the Confederacy."
"I agree as well," said Shakti.
Yoda nodded slowly, his reluctance leaching into the Force. Here in the Council Chamber, there was supposed to be only the barest of personal shields. Half the discussion was normally carried out in the Force itself. But today, Plo could sense hardly anything from his fellow counselors. It was not a good sign.
"Of treason you wish to speak," Yoda said.
Some of the Jedi looked at Adi, who glanced aside at first before finally meeting their eyes. Her hands were white-knuckled into fists. Shakti's gaze flicked quickly to Plo, and then to Syndralic standing behind his chair.
"Treason," said Eve Goth. "I think blasphemy might be a better topic."
He looked around at them all, his eyes flashing.
"Tell me that this body did not decide to do what I was told that it did. Tell me that you did not decide to go against our mandate."
"Our mandate is to defend the Republic, Master Koth," the Dark Woman interrupted, "by whatever means necessary."
"Whatever means?" Even Pyle demanded. "We are Jedi! Whatever means is the way of the Sith. It is not our way. What was suggested should never have been voted upon, let alone passed."
"But it was passed," Apo Rancisis pointed out, "and was not carried out. And now we speak of treason."
"If that sentence had been carried out immediately, then there would be no treason," Coleman Trevor began to say. "Then we wouldn't know about the traitors in this order," the Dark Woman corrected. She crossed her arms over her chest, looking around the room. "At least Kenobi's escape was good for something. He flushed them out into the open. Some of them."
"What are you suggesting?"
Mace Windu said, his voice heavy. The Dark Woman met his eyes.
"I think you know what I'm suggesting, Mace."
"Then say it out loud."
"There are traitors to the Republic and to the Jedi in the Order right now," said the Dark Woman.
She looked directly at Plo, and he felt the weight of her judgment in the Force before she added, "And some of them are in this room with us." Even Mace couldn't keep from glancing at Plo, a quick flicker of his eyes sideways before he looked back at the Dark Woman.
"Weighty words those are," Yoda said. "Not to be spoken of lightly, treason is."
"Nor should it so be committed," said Ki-Adi-Mundi. "Obi-Wan did not escape from this temple. He was released from custody. There are 5 other Jedi missing from the temple. 6, if we count Master Unduli, though she could hardly have been at fault for this. Only a High Counselor could have released him from his cell, and no member of this body is absent."
"But one of their apprentices is," Stacey said.
"Yes," Plo said, since it seemed to be expected of him. "Ahsoka went with Obi-Wan. She felt that it was best for her."
"You knew of this?" Adigalia's voice was shocked,
and when she looked at him, there was hurt in her eyes and in the Force. Plo had the indistinct sense that she had guessed, but this was the first time that she had spoken of her suspicions to him.
"I knew," Plo said.
Ki-Adi-Mundi shook his head slowly.
"Kenobi is a traitor to the Republic and to this Order. Anyone who helped him is now guilty of those crimes as well. Padawan Offee's affection for her master might excuse her actions, but Padawan Tano? Master Voss and the others? There is no excuse."
"An excuse," Plo said. "Should there be an excuse? Ahsoka and the others did as they felt was right. For themselves, for the Force, for the Order."
"For the Order!" the Dark Woman spat. "For the Force! Obi-Wan Kenobi is a traitor! The Jedi that released him aren't worthy of the name!"
Addie's voice went cold.
"A Jedi is still a Jedi, even when she acts against the will of this council, Anya. We are Jedi before we are anything else, even outside this order."
"Of course you'd think that, Addie." Addie straightened in her chair.
"If you're talking about Stas, Anya, come out and say it."
"Fine," the Dark Woman said.
"Your former apprentice betrayed the Order and the Republic for the Naboo and for Obi-Wan Kenobi. And we're supposed to believe that you didn't know Stas Alley was a traitor?"
Plo saw Adi breathe in, but she didn't take the bait. Her voice soft, she said,
"You're accusing me of treason?"
Mace raised a hand before the Dark Woman could respond.
"Let's try and stick to one crime at a time," he said. "Dark Woman, I think that all the members of this council would appreciate it if you could refrain from making unsubstantiated accusations. You're here as a courtesy, because you sat proxy for Master Koth during Captain Kenobi's trial. You do not have a vote."
The Dark Woman inclined her head slightly, arching a pale eyebrow.
"As you wish, Master Windu."
"Good." Mace rested his hands on the arms of his chair.
5 Jedi, not counting Obi-Wan, left the temple. We know that Quinlan Vos and the Padawans Ahsoka Tano and Barriss Offee accompanied Kenobi to Alderaan, where they met with Queen Amidala and were joined by Luminata Unduli. What we don't know is where Thom and Thrasa have gone, or whether they had anything to do with Obi-Wan's escape. Given the timing and the relationship between Vos and Thom, it's likely, but it isn't certain. Let's not make rash assumptions. Thom and Tra both have a predilection for acting without asking permission from this council."
He paused, obviously waiting for someone to contradict him.
"Thrasa had been his master, of course. Her disappearance had to be hitting Mace almost as hard as Stas's treason was hitting Adi. At least I know where Ahsoka is. It was different for Master than it was for an apprentice, but the emotions were very similar."
When nobody spoke, Mace went on.
"Obi-Wan's cell was code-locked so that only a High Counselor could release him. Neither Master Thom nor Master Saw had access. It's not impossible that it was sliced, but none of those Jedi had the skill to do so, and there's no indication in the system that the Temple Guards can find."
He paused, pressing his lips together.
Plo could feel some of the other counselors looking at him, weighing Ahsoka's absence against his presence here. A few were shooting speculative glances at Adi, who was staring straight ahead, her mouth set in a thin line.
"So one of us," Even Pyle said at last, "let Obi-Wan Kenobi out. This war will drag on, because one of us decided to take the law into his own hands and commit treason." "Is it treason to follow the remit of this order?" Deepa asked. "The Force judged Captain Kenobi innocent." "Of using the dark side," Even Pyle protested. "Not of crimes against the order." "If we cannot trust the Force to tell us when a knight is innocent of the sins he is accused of,
Obi-Wan Kenobi is not a knight. He passed the trials.
That does not make him a knight.
Then what? Mace slammed his fist down on the arm of his chair. Quiet! Obi-Wan's position doesn't matter. What matters is that some Jedi acted against the direct orders of this council and released him.
Plo steepled his fingers together, aware that Shaak-Ti was trying to catch his eye.
It was I who let Obi-Wan go, he said. The others made their own choices, and I will not speak for them. But I was the one who let Obi-Wan Kenobi out of his cell.
Your wish is my command, Your Highness, Ani said, spared a quick moment for prayer, and banked the twilight sharply, cutting so close to one of the Naboo starfighters that the proximity alarm screamed, Shut up! They kept wailing, and he slammed his palm down on the override control. The cockpit abruptly went silent, except for the harsh breathing of the others.
Okay, Ani said. Okay.
He flexed his fingers against the yoke, then triggered the ship's comm and said, Everyone, strap in. This is gonna be rough. The sensor boards lit up with incoming weapons fire. Ani ignored the way that his heart was pounding and jerked the twilight down below the field of fire, feeling rather than seeing the laser blasts go over them. He could see the oncoming starfighters in the viewport now, a sharp-nosed body with a pair of rectangular wings mounted on either side. Ani, who studied starship holomags religiously, could honestly say that he had never seen them before. The one nearest the twilight exploded in a fireball as Captain Kenobi depressed the trigger on the gunnery controls. Ani brought the ship up, feeling some of the debris clatter against the twilight's hull as they skimmed the blast radius. Two N1s passed them, spitting blue laser fire that the strange starfighters dodged past. Kenobi scowled and fired again, his brow furrowed in concentration, but the blasts passed harmlessly beneath the unfamiliar ships. Ani felt the moment that one of the fighters got the twilight in his targeting solution, a quiet click in his mind, even before the sensors registered it. He swore and tried to bring the ship down, but couldn't get out of the way in time, and the entire ship shuddered as the twin laser blasts struck the viewport dead center, energy spreading out across the transparasteel in front of Ani. He caught his breath, but the shields held, and a moment later the starfighter exploded as a shot from the twilight's top guns bored through the cockpit. Ani was already angling away, trying to keep the curve of the planet in sight. Three of the strange starfighters cut across his path, forcing him back towards the scrum even as they dodged the twilight's laser fire. They were so close that Ani could hear the scream of their ion engines even through the hull of the twilight. Oh, no, you don't, Ani said, and leaned back into the seat as he flipped the twilight back and went straight up, in the direction of the star, the ship's inertial dampeners groaning protest at the quick change. He felt rather than saw the starfighters trying to compensate. They were faster and more maneuverable than the light freighter, but a ship was only as good as its pilot, and he didn't think they had a scratch on him. "I'm lining him up for you," he said to Kenobi, and jerked the yoke sideways, sending the twilight into a spin. For a moment, stars, planet, and ships blurred in front of him, a thin mockery of hyperspace. Then Ani slammed back on the controls and straightened out, with a starfighter directly in Kenobi's line of fire, just the way Ani had known he was going to be. They were close enough that he could see the pilot's black flight suit and helmet through the viewport, before Kenobi fired the twilight's forward guns and the starfighter exploded. Ani drove the twilight forward through the debris, the shields sparking a little as the wreckage clattered off the ship's sides. His sensor boards lit up too late for him to dodge the laser fire that came from behind him, and Ani grimaced as damage reports scrolled down his boards. Shields are down to 50%, Ahsoka reported from behind him. Obi-Wan, Queen Amidala said warningly. We don't have time for this, Kenobi said to Ani.
I'm working on it,
Ani said through his teeth. He sent the twilight dodging sideways out of the way of a burst of laser blasts.
Will someone get those damn Vipers over here?
He was a good star pilot, probably the best in his business, but what Ani Skywalker wasn't was a star fighter pilot. And this was the kind of dogfight that he had never been in before and had no idea how to fly.
Stars help me if I get the Queen of Naboo blown up.
Ani felt the opening in the starfighter formation before he saw it. He slammed the control yoke forward and hit the thrusters at the same time, feeling the twilight straining around him at the effort. Blue laser fire shot out from the ship's forward guns, turning one of the starfighters into a fireball. The incoming N1 Vipers took care of the three of the remaining four, while the Twilight's top guns struck out the fourth fighter's rectangular wings and sent it careening into the debris field of one of the others before it exploded too. But there were more fighters coming in on his sensor boards. Ani heard a missile lock alert sound and resisted the urge to panic, looking up to see that they hadn't gotten any closer to the planet and were, in fact, further away from it than they had originally jumped in. Which gave him an idea. R2, calculate a hyperspace jump that will put us as close into Ruxus Secundus as you can, he said. You want to what? Ahsoka burst out. Are you insane? Trust me. Obi-Wan, can this be done? The Queen asked. Ani jerked the Twilight out of the way of the incoming missiles, watching as their paths corrected to come after them. He could see the source, the big warship that had come out of the shelter of the moon. An instant later, laser fire destroyed one of the missiles, but the second was bearing down on them, and with the Twilight's shields depleted, he knew they couldn't survive the hit if it struck.
Maybe, Kenobi said.
He fired as Ani rolled the ship to avoid the remaining missile. Ani saw the thing dodging nimbly out of the way of the laser fire.
Yes, I think so. If you're good enough.
Fortunately for you, I'm an excellent pilot.
Fortunately for you, I'm an excellent shot,
Kenobi returned as the second missile vanished under a barrage of laser fire. R2-D2 chortled a response, and a moment later the hyperspace coordinates scrolled across Ani's boards.
Here goes nothing, he said,
took one hand off the control yoke, and pulled the hyperdrive lever down.
I may lose the chancellorship over this.
Dooku took a last look at his datapad, which was displaying the talking points that his speechwriters had come up with for him, then tossed it down on his desk. Up above the holding office, the Senate was gathered in full session. Or at least, what was left of the Senate was gathered.
Enough systems had left to join the Confederacy or the Alliance that their absence was notable, the empty repulsor pods left behind an ugly reminder of how close the Republic was to failing. It had been Dooku's first to hold together and second to restore, and he had failed miserably in both regards. Taking Naboo without capturing the Queen meant a long, drawn-out war that would inevitably lead to more systems leaving the Republic for the Confederacy or the Alliance. At best, it might force the Council of Neutral Systems back to the Republic. At worst, the Republic would not survive this war. Dooku passed a hand over his face, exhausted and weary, then remembered to unclip his lightsaber from his belt and put it in one of his desk drawers, code-locking it against the prying of any of his aides. After the attack on Yoda, he had taken to wearing it again, but it was unwise to do so openly in public, especially in the Convocation Chamber. Though it was hardly a secret, most senators felt better if it wasn't obvious that once upon a time, the Supreme Chancellor had been a Jedi Knight. Straightening the fall of his robes, Dooku started towards the Chancellor's podium, which would rise up from the holding office into the Convocation Chamber above it. Midway there, he paused, frowning. He should already have been joined by the Vice Chair, his staff aide, and the other attendants that occupied the lower level of the podium. It wasn't like any of them to be late. Scowling to himself, Dooku removed his comlink from an inner pocket. Before he could turn it on, he heard the doors to the holding office slide open behind him. It's about time. The Force whispered a warning an instant before two lightsabers ignited.
You're right, Jedi, said a woman's voice. It is time. Time for you to die.